This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk with Judge Bob Downing, one of the most colorful and outspoken people to ever be on the bench in this area or any other. Judge Bob Downing will come in on matters of the court and other matters, including tonight's presidential debate at Hofstra University. President Obama trying to come back from a disappointing performance in debate number one against Governor Romney, who impressed many with his initial performance on October 3rd. Tonight they square off in debate number two in a three-debate situation. And the election is 3 weeks away. We will talk with Gary Hart, the former U.S. Senator from Colorado, who was a presidential candidate in 1984 and in 1988. All this today, first the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us online at inkstershow@wrkf.org. We begin with Judge Bob Downing. For 25 years, he was a judge in this community, the last 10 on the Court of Appeal. And Judge Bob Downing is a man who knows the law and a few other things. And last time he was on this program, we were talking about his bout with hypomania. And he has come back strong and vigorously. And that was an interesting time in your life.
Oh, very interesting.
Have you sold the cars you bought?
I have sold. My brother-in-law in Colorado has the 71 Rolls Royce. I sold the three motorcycles. The last one I have left is the 52 police car, which I really like. It's a Ford, 52 Ford. It's got a Pontiac engine in it. And I've had, there's this place in Zachary will make tags. And I put on the side of it, it's got on a mission from God with a little hat and Blues Brothers sunglasses. And I got an amp with a speaker so I can play Peter Gunn as I go down the street. That's hard to let go.
Has fallen off, but I tell you what, you've come back like a champ. And this is something that's serious stuff, and you battled it vigorously. But you had a few interesting weeks, didn't you?
Oh, well, I've had people in college that were manic depressive, and they always seemed like a lot of fun, but I never saw them when they were depressive. But I tell you what, mania is the best you've ever felt in your life. If you could bottle that and just take a little sip every now and then and not have it last too long, it'd be great.
But you went on a shopping spree and bought a lot of expensive automobiles, and I suspect put your family in somewhat of a financial bind.
Yes, so I'm back at work. I'm with the personal injury firm of Duay Price, and there's a whole bunch of other people who I'm sure would like me to mention them. Scott Andrews, Randy Piedrahita, Kurt Guidry.
Big firm.
Yes, it's a well-known firm. Paul Duay is one of the smartest guys you ever meet in your life. He lives in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, although he's thinking about selling his place if you're interested in a house in the Virgin Islands.
Yeah, that would be an interesting place to do this program.
Right.
You would probably be my only guest in studio. But Judge Bob Downing, you still have your police vehicle, but other than that, you've shed all the expensive automobiles you bought during your manic point. By the way, is that correct? Was it a manic episode or is it a mania episode?
It was a manic episode. Caused by a side effect from some medicine I was taking. I felt wonderful. There's no better feeling in the world. And when it started, I was in Yosemite up on a mountain. The sun was going down. Mm-hmm. The moon was coming up. And God was talking to me. We were having a serious conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, this man has had an interesting life. And later in the hour, we're slated to hear from Gary Hart, who, as we know, ran for president a few times. Let's turn the clock back. It's the fall of 1968. Hubert Humphrey, LSU graduate, is running for president as the Democratic Party nominee. He's facing Richard Nixon and George Wallace. And you're in Hatcher Hall, right?
How do you remember this stuff?
Hatcher Hall, second floor?
Second floor.
And your next door neighbor is?
Well, I was the dorm counselor. Actually, I was on the first floor at that time, as I was the dorm counselor for Hatcher Hall, and my good friend David Duke was on the second or third floor. I can't remember. But he had a copy of Mein Kampf next to the bed. He had an autographed picture of George Lincoln Rockwell, and he had the Nazi naval emblem behind the bed, the flag.
And he was 18 years old.
He was, and he smart guy. He would look through all his Nazi literature and then borrow my notes from geology class, and he got a few points more. The notes were better for him than for me. I finally beat him out at the last.
Well, at that point, he was making a splash at Free Speech Alley with these outrageous statements, and little did we know that 22 years later, he would almost get elected to the U.S. Senate.
Correct. And there was a guy named Mike Connolly, very conservative. He was Young Americans for Freedom. He wrote something in the Reveille. And most people ignored David as being a nutcase. When he got the publicity, he realized how much bad publicity helped him, any kind of publicity, getting his name out there. And it was like in Mein Kampf when Hitler says, "I discovered I could speak." Made a big, big difference. And David realized that the people that supported him, kind of rednecks, they wouldn't support a Nazi because they fought against the Germans in World War II. They might have had some of the same ideas, but they distinguished themselves. So he starts going towards the Klan. Then he realizes that he needs to broaden his base. So he becomes conservative Republican. He's read Mein Kampf numerous times. I was surprised he didn't make a bigger move when the Rodney King thing came down. I think he's gotten off into gambling or something like that.
Yeah, he's now living in the in Russia, and he has a checkered past. He spent time in prison. If, like Al Capone, they got him for tax evasion.
Yeah.
And David Ernest Duke has, because of his federal conviction, it's stymied his electoral pursuits. Otherwise, he would still be a candidate in Louisiana. And in our open primary system, he could be definitely a nuisance candidate. He could determine who wins or loses elections. He would not win, but he could determine who wins.
Right. And I still have an autographed picture from him. It's when he was in the Reveille. He's got his Klan robes on. There's a burning cross in the back. And I got him to autograph it. It says, "To my commie pinko liberal friend, yours truly, David Duke."
That was what, 1969 maybe?
Probably 69.
69, yeah. When he was all of 18, about to be 19 years old. And little did we know that he would end up becoming the favorite son for 55% of the white voters in the governor's race against Edwin Washington Edwards in 1991. And if not for the wisdom of the African-American voters, David Duke would have been both U.S. Senator Duke and Governor Duke from the great state of Louisiana.
Well, that's a scary thing. You know, how would you feel if you went to school with David Duke, knowing he's a Nazi, knowing he's a Klansman, and he gets almost wins the governorship? What does that make you? You know, you're, you know, a piker or something?
Well, who roomed with this guy?
He was in a room by himself.
That was unusual. I couldn't get a room by myself when I was at LSU.
I don't know. There was a little scandal there when he took a bunch of football players with him to go see The Birth of a Nation, which people learn is the first epic movie. Cecil B. DeMille, what they don't realize is it's about the birth of the Ku Klux Klan, not the birth of America. Mm-hmm. The Birth of the Nation is a long movie, and they got up and applauded. Woodrow Wilson called it history written in lightning.
And as a result of that, the parkway through Jackson, Mississippi is named in honor of one Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
Great Democratic president, by the way, who led us through World War I, but on racial matters, far from progressive.
Correct.
297-5633, if you'd like to join us. And as we noted, Bob Downing is a man who has been around the block a few times in political circles. What about running for judge? Judges quite often get contributions from lawyers. Is that a good thing?
Well, they take contributions from anybody, but the problem is the average person does not donate to a judge. You get very few non-lawyers donating to any judge, conservative. Well, they don't have liberals in Louisiana, but moderates. And then they complain about justice or who the judges are. Well, if you're not going to help support somebody, you're not going to put out a yard sign, you're not going to write them a little check, where's your basis for complaining? When I first won for district court, I had two people gave $25 a piece that were not lawyers. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And they wonder why, you know, all these lawyers are involved in judges' campaigns. It's because nobody else is. But the rule is the judge, you know, when I first ran in 84, you could solicit yourself, and you knew who your contributors were. Now you have to have a committee to solicit, and you're not supposed to know who your contributors are, although that means you're not supposed to read the newspaper where they publish the names of all your contributors. So how does that work?
Now, you ran as a Democrat all those years?
Yes, I did run as a Democrat all those years.
Could you be elected today as a Democrat?
I doubt it. People become a lot more conservative in East Baton Rouge mm-hmm. Parish. You used to have a lot of labor people. Judge Doherty told me, go to the Exxon gates at 3 in the morning, shake hands with people. I did that. There was not a single voter from East Baton Rouge Parish. They were all from Crotch Springs or Livingston or Gonzales. The blue-collar people have fled, but mainly because of the public schools. They don't have the money to send their kids to private school, mm-hmm. so they go out to Livingston or Gonzales. So well, it's kind of sad.
It's curious that you stayed a Democrat despite being conservative on some issues and openly being a devout Christian. And I had a discussion with that great philosopher Arlo Guthrie several months ago, and he was commenting that he thought it was curious that the Republican Party has become the party of Jesus and God when statistics show that the most religious people in the United States are African Americans who are overwhelmingly Democratic. And his contention was that Democrats are more religious than Republicans.
Well, if you set a black Christian and a white Christian black Christian Democrat and a white Christian Republican, they would agree on all of those religious issues, but the blacks still vote Democrat because when the time came to desegregate or do right, the Dixiecrats transferred over to the Republican Party. So when they look at the Republican Party, they see the same Dixiecrats that were standing in the doorways to the schools, that were fire hosing mm-hmm. them, things like that. So they cannot in good conscience vote Republican because that's who they see in the Republican Party, the same people, the George Wallaces. And, you know, they think about it. All those guys became Republican.
But Mitt Romney, he's a Mormon, and to my knowledge, he hasn't said a word about he could play the race card, but he hasn't, to his credit. He's a different kind of Republican, isn't he?
Oh, I'd say he's a different kind of Republican. He doesn't breathe the same air that we little folks breathe in him.
But many of his surrogates are playing the race card. Kevin says we ought to listen.
You
to
mean
Luke
the 47%? Is that what you're talking about?
I don't know that had a racial context to it, but some might think it does. But they're only 13% of the country. Only 13% of the country is African American. So if he's talking about 47%, he's talking about mostly white folks.
That's a good point.
297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. We'll be back with Judge Bob Downing after this 1 minute timeout on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. You may reach us online, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In studio for a bit longer is Judge Bob Downing. And he is a man who, as I stated, who was around the political circles for a long time, 25 years as a judge. And he's known a few candidates going back to his college days when he was the, resident assistant?
Yeah, we call them dorm counselors. It wasn't as nerdy as Proctor.
And one of the people under his supervision was freshman David Ernest Duke from John F. Kennedy High School in New Orleans, Louisiana. Now, Bob Downing, did you ever cross paths with one Gary Hart?
I did. He was down at the Jack Tar Capitol House up in the top in the ballroom when he was running for president, and I have an autographed picture of him with the flannel shirt and the axe as he's cutting wood, the stupid things that candidates do. Who knew he had all the qualifications of Bill Clinton at that time?
except
Donna Rice was a lot better looking than Monica Lewinsky.
All right, well, here we were talking about race, and I must say that in one man's opinion, I don't think Mitt Romney has played the race card, and that's to his credit. But some surrogates out there who are former opponents of Governor Romney, now supporting his bid for the White House, people like Newton Leroy Gingrich, here's what he's saying.
I'm assuming there's some rhythm to Barack Obama that the rest of us don't understand, whether he needs large amounts of rest, whether he needs to go play basketball for a while. I don't watch ESPN.
Now, that the person laughing was the interviewer at Fox News, but I don't see how you could listen to that and not say that there was a racial context to those remarks from Congressman Gingrich.
Well, the real question is, can Obama jump? That is the real question.
Well, I know you're being facetious, but this is serious stuff.
Well, I know his mother was white, his father was black. You know, if he has white man's disease, can't jump.
You can't resist, can you? But no, but you're being whimsical. Gingrich was not. Gingrich was trying to inflame prejudice.
Correct. Out of one side of his mouth, he will talk about a white girl who does not have an abortion, and she's called a birth mother. Isn't that sweet?
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have an abortion. The other side talks about a black mother who doesn't get an abortion and has her child and keeps it. What do you call her?
A welfare mom.
A welfare mother. Very good.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It seems a little, there's something missing there.
No doubt. No doubt about it. Of course, Gingrich has also been married 3 times and bloviates about values and Bill Clinton and Gary Hart, and these guys have never been divorced.
Yeah, and was it Gingrich was having an affair with a woman in the choir while his wife was dying of cancer? It seems to be.
I don't know if it was a woman in the choir, but he was, and his wife did not die, by the way. She, his first wife, had ovarian cancer and recovered, but he was having an affair with wife number two during that episode, and then he left wife number two for wife number three. He was having an affair with an aide while he was denouncing Bill Clinton for having an affair with an aide.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
297-5633.
But he wasn't president. Yeah.
Christian man that you are, former judge, lawyer, what do you think of the death penalty?
Well, it's interesting. People who are against abortion are generally in favor of the death penalty, and then your liberal or anti-death penalty people are in favor of abortion. You seldom find somebody who is against abortion and also against the death penalty. Me, I'm whatever the legislature says. Yeah, there are some people that are just beyond redemption, it seems like, but I have met a lot of people that I thought were beyond redemption that have totally turned their lives around. One of them being Ashante Witherspoon. He was in a shootout with police, got a .357 through his mouth, got paroled after 27 and a half years on a 75 year sentence, and he's assistant pastor out at Miracle Place Church. And the pastor, Ricky Sinclair, used to be a drug dealer. And that church is 60-40 black-white. It's got, it took over a shopping center. They've got an all-the-way house, not a halfway house. They don't even allow smoking. They go pick up people off the streets that are drug, alcohol, and they reform them. It's amazing. And, you know, your mainline churches are not doing that. You got Bethany maybe and Healing Place Church that reach out and that are integrated, that I don't know of any. There might be a few others, but they're not a whole lot.
297-5633 for Judge Bob Downing. Samir says Bill Clinton was in favor of the death penalty and abortion rights. So there's an example of being pro and pro on those issues. But you say
which is very unusual.
Okay, but Michael Dukakis, he ran in 1988 for abortion rights against the death penalty. And remember the first question in the debate from Bernard Shaw of CNN to Michael Dukakis basically killed the Dukakis campaign was this query about the death penalty.
The first question goes to Governor Dukakis. You have 2 minutes to respond. Governor, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent. And
all right, and
you have very few repeat offenders after the death penalty, though.
Well, there you go. Well, Bob Downing, you're always a provocative guest. Great to visit with you, and you're involved in another civic endeavor. This Saturday, the annual Pancake Festival from the Baton Rouge downtown Kiwanis. It will be held at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center, and you've got your purple and gold shirt on. This will be a prelude to the LSU's game on the road at Kyle Field in College Station, Texas, against Texas A&M. What will happen Saturday, 6 a.m. at the PMAC?
We have the annual downtown Kiwanis breakfast. It's from 6 o'clock to 12:30. If you get your tickets early, they're $5 a piece. It's a whole $5.50 at the door. And downtown Kiwanis supports a huge number of projects. Teach a Kid to Fish, St. Vincent de Paul Pharmacy. There's a great program, Project Ride, with Reverend William King out in Baker. He teaches kids how to take care of horses and build up some responsibility. The International Hospitality Foundation. For the last couple of years, we've taken in less money, and we've had to reduce the $1,000 scholarships we give to the top nursing students to about $500. So we could really use the help. Now, are you familiar with Kiwanis and what they stand for?
Yeah.
So what is Kiwanis?
Well, what you do is help people. This pancake breakfast, how long have you been involved with this, Bob? It's been how many years?
I had kind of gotten out of Kiwanis, not able to make the meetings, and after I retired, I got back in. So it's a long time ago. It was a good bit, and now it's just 3 years. But since you asked me what Kiwanis is,
you asked me.
It's a global organization of volunteers dedicated to changing the world one child and one community at a time.
Okay. Thank you, Bob Downing. Judge Bob Downing, always a pleasure. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. And with us, a special guest, former U.S. Senator Gary Hart, the man who has been involved in American politics for well over 40 years. 40 years ago, he was the campaign manager for George McGovern as the senator from South Dakota got the Democratic nomination for president. And, of course, Gary Hart, in 1984, received almost 7 million votes in his quest to become the Democratic nominee and lost a narrow race to Walter Mondale 28 years ago. Good morning, Senator Hart.
Good morning. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Good to hear your voice, Senator Hart. And since we're talking presidential politics tonight, debate number two, what's your perception about what President Obama must do in his debate with Governor Romney?
Well, of course, the pundits say we're going to see a different Obama tonight. I think the real question is whether we'll see which Romney we will see, the moderate Romney that showed up the first debate, or the much more conservative Romney who got the Republican nomination. And I think there will be not only extensive attention to the president's performance, but a very critical attention to how Governor Romney appears also.
Well, for those who say debates really don't make that much of a difference, it does appear that the first debate moved the poll numbers forward for Governor Romney. How do you explain this?
Well, I think they do make a difference, certainly for the undecided voters. What the pundits tell us now is that there are fewer of those than in most years, that people have made up their mind earlier and sooner, and that we are in a virtual tie in the overall voting, 47-47 or something like that. So it really is a contest for 2 or 3% of the vote, and I think in that respect, general demeanor and in the negative sense, avoidance of catastrophe are very, very important to those voters.
Now, 40 years ago, when you were handling Senator McGovern's campaign, Richard Nixon would not debate Senator McGovern. Those days are long gone, but it would seem that in the case of President Obama, he was doing much better before he got on the same stage with Governor Romney.
Well, he debated extensively with, first of all, I think for those of us who were high school debaters, what now passes for debates are really not debates, because there is very little, with the exception of the vice presidential debate most recently, there's very little exchange between the two speakers. But in any case, let's call them debates, he's appeared with the opponents quite often. In 08, particularly, then Senator Clinton, and his ultimate rival, and did very well. So how you account for one appearance, I don't know. I think we all imagine what went on behind the scenes, that he decided to be presidential and not attack and so forth. The interesting thing to me as an observer is that he was heavily criticized for being too not being aggressive enough, and the same observers or commentators went over the top with Vice President Biden for being too aggressive. So it's a no-win proposition.
On the whole, how do you assess the first term of President Obama?
Very difficult. No one's going to say it was a huge success, him most of all. But the country he ended up governing was not the one he thought he was going to govern. The economy fell apart virtually in the middle of the 08 campaign. And it must be said, although some people don't like it said, that he inherited a mess, particularly in the financial sector. And the second guessers are saying, well, he shouldn't have bailed out the banks and so forth. But if you go back and read the commentary from so supposedly knowledgeable economists and financial experts, he had no choice. So it is too bad that we have financial institutions too big to fail, and they should be broken up. But the chances of that happening, given their lobbying pressure in Washington, is practically nil.
Now, you served in the U.S. Senate with Joseph Biden, and his debate reviews have been mixed, to say the least. Some say he won going away as far as the issues, but others say when it comes to aesthetics, he did a poor job with the smiling and the interrupting. What's your perception of Senator and now Vice President Biden?
Well, first of all, he is a friend, and I value the 12 years we served together. He's verbally gifted, and that has been both a blessing and a curse. He's has a very quick way with words, and quite often has been known to speak before he has been able to edit what he is saying. But I thought he handled himself very well. Those who thought he was over the top were, of course, his opponents. And as I say, many commentators who were equally critical of President Obama for being too laid back and not aggressive enough. So you're never going to satisfy the critics. I thought he did a good job.
Your passion of recent vintage, and when you were running for president, you were considered to be one of the foremost authorities on foreign policy, and that's an issue right now that is testy for the president in particular, considering the events of last month in Libya. How vulnerable is President Obama on this?
Well, if Governor Romney and his running mate were more experienced internationally, I would say he had some vulnerabilities, but they are clearly not. They have not had the experience internationally that President Obama and Vice President Biden have had. Even they're not even close. And it must be said that Governor Romney is relying on almost exclusively on those who advised George W. Bush internationally to our great detriment in Iraq and elsewhere. So if you want to look at a Romney presidency internationally, you're going to see a rerun, I think, of the George W. Bush years. It must be said that the world is in revolution. The Arab Spring totally upturned Northern Africa and the Middle East, and that's a whole set of governments that we had dealt with for decades is suddenly almost overnight disappeared. That's a new phenomenon. The fact is, in terms of Libya, our embassies are guarded, but they can't be. They're turning into fortresses, and I visited quite a number of them in recent years, and it's sad because embassies are there to show the American flag and for our diplomats to mix and mingle, not only with foreign leaders, but with opposition people, with journalists, with students and others. And they're now being confined increasingly behind fortress walls. The symbolism is terrible. And the fact is, most diplomats I've talked to say they can't do their job because of this. And finally, where Libya is concerned, security experts say another 20 or 30 Marines who do guard the embassies in Tripoli or even over where the consulate was, Benghazi, could probably not have protected the ambassador. It's a very, very complex and difficult situation. Governor Romney is predictably trying to take advantage of it, but you don't make or criticize a foreign policy on one event.
2975633. We'll go to the phone lines in a few moments with Senator Hart, who served in the U.S. Senate 12 years, January 3, 1975 to January 3, 1987. You have been chairman for Council for a Livable World. How is that endeavor going?
Well, it's a 50-year-old organization largely started by nuclear physicists in the Cambridge, Massachusetts area at Harvard and MIT back in the height of the Cold War when the arms race was getting out of hand. And these experts got together and tried to figure out a way to educate members of Congress on exactly what a nuclear weapon was and what it could do, so that they didn't just mindlessly continue to vote for bigger and bigger stockpiles. And, of course, now in retrospect, they were right. We and the Soviets built many, many, many more warheads and delivery systems than could ever possibly have been used even in an all-out nuclear exchange. And since the end of the Cold War, those stockpiles have been coming down. But as I said before, it is a difficult world, and we're seeing the spread of weapons of mass destruction, not just nuclear, but biological and chemical. And so organizations of this kind, which seek to provide facts and information outside the framework of ideology.
Hold tight. We'll be back with Senator Gary Hart after this one-minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and we're pleased to have Senator Gary Hart with us for a few minutes longer. 297-5633-877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Senator Hart, as we went to the break, was discussing his involvement in trying to extract nuclear weapons from the landscape. He is chairman for Council for a Livable World, and as we hit the break, you were saying that we're having a proliferation of nuclear weaponry rather than a reduction. Why is this the case?
No, actually, to clarify what I was saying, first of all, I'm no longer the chairman of the Council for a Livable World. I am chairing a Defense Department committee called the Threat Reduction Committee, which is seeking to do the same thing. What worries me is not the spread of nuclear weapons so much, although Iran is a serious, serious challenge to all of us. It's the spread of chemical and biological weapons into what I guess you'd call non-state hands, into tribes, clans, and gangs, al-Qaedas of the world. It's much easier to manufacture chemical and biological weapons and even distribute them than it is to deliver a nuclear weapon. But all of them are threats, and we continue to try to organize the international community to reduce those threats, and it's a real challenge in the 21st century.
50 years ago today, the initial stages of the Cuban Missile Crisis began. Now, you were a young man then. I'm sure that's still a vivid memory to this day.
Oh, it is for all people of my generation. And I think my children and others since then kind of look on it as a strange period in our history. And it was strange, but it was also very scary. And the interesting thing is new facts continue to come out about that. There are now books being written about what was going on behind the scenes based on information in the Soviet Union that we didn't have. I've had the chance to visit with Mr. Castro on several occasions about this. And the scariest part of it that we didn't know at the time were that the Soviets and the Cubans had short-range, low-yield, but still highly dangerous nuclear warheads that had a 25-mile range, two kiloton weapons we designated as frogs, and they were prepared to use them if our Marines had gone ashore. That, it turns out, in retrospect, was the real danger.
Now, Gary Hart lives in Colorado, and this is a swing state, and today, if you've seen the New York Times, there's a story about Nevada, also a swing state, and it says the commercials are flying at a rate of 10,000 per week, 98 different ads in rotation. I would imagine this is exhausting. Does it get to a point where people are paying attention anymore?
No. I think ordinary, everyday Americans have tuned it out a long time ago. I think it's overkill. You can blame the candidates, but I blame the so-called media advisors mostly. The sad part of all this unbelievably expensive campaigning is that the people who put it together are highly paid so-called consultants or strategists. And frankly, some of them, the media advisors, get paid by how many ads they make and how often they run. So there's a commercial incentive in campaigns to overkill, and that's really what's been going on.
2975633, please be brief. Dorothy in Goodwood, you're on with Senator Hart. Good morning, Dorothy.
Good morning. A pleasure to speak to you, Senator Hart. I have a hypothetical for you. What happens on November 7th if we wake up and Romney is president, the Senate is controlled by Republicans, the House remains under Republican control, the states are largely Republican, as we well know, and so are the local governments.
All right. What happens if Republicans have total control?
Well, hardcore Democrats have been heard to say in previous years, where Richard Nixon and others were concerned that they would pack up and go somewhere else. That's not going to happen. Again, I revert to what I said originally. I think it will a lot depend on which President Romney it is, whether it's the moderate centrist governor of Massachusetts, or whether it's the candidate for the nomination of a party, which is a lot of which is influenced by what I think can be called a very, very conservative, even to the right elements. And whether he's free of those elements and can, in fact, seek to reach accommodation with Democrats in the Congress will be the key. And I would hope my party would be much more willing to work with a Republican president than Republicans, particularly in the House, have been willing to work with President Obama.
877-217-5757. Dominic in Grand Coteau, you're on with Gary Hart. Hi, Dominic.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Hart, watching, you know, the politics over the last 25 years or so, I've noticed how the Republicans have done a bait and switch on all these important issues. And then the Democrats, they seem to be more timid on their approach to issues and to candidates, like, you know, once again, the presidential debate. And it seems like the Democrats are playing into the Republicans' game plan and just can't seem to get a foothold, because if they do what Biden did, they're being aggressive. They do what Obama did, they're being soft on him. So, I mean, what do you do? How do you get this playing field level and get the points across?
I couldn't disagree with your analysis one bit. I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head. I think what happened was, and I had a small role to play in all this, in the 70s and 80s, the economy began to stagnate because of OPEC oil embargoes and foreign competition, a variety of other factors, and the increase in health care costs and Social Security and Medicare. And people's incomes were not increasing. They've been flat, except for the top 1%, for quite a long time. And therefore, to continue to pay taxes for New Deal-inspired programs when the economy was flat became less and less appealing. And a new Republican Party emerged that pretty much purged its moderate elements and became much, much more conservative. The Rupert Murdochs of the world played a key role in all of that, as have others. But what my competition with former Vice President Mondale in 84 and the mid-80s was about whether we clung to the New Deal past or whether we invented new ways to make the economy grow so that we could afford to pay for the social contract and the safety net that Democrats have always stood for. And that never got resolved to anybody's satisfaction in the 80s. President Clinton was successful because he moved to some vague center and more or less abandoned, as he said, the role of government, or at least what he called big government, and forged, as the Republican Party became more confrontational, forged a kind of moderate center, and the economy boomed because of the technology bubble. So that got us through the 90s, but now we're back where we started from, and the tax cuts and the two wars have and the deregulation of the financial sector have got us in a mess.
Now, Republicans often compare President Obama's term in office to that of Jimmy Carter. And a week before the 1980 election, it was considered to be a toss-up between Carter and Reagan, and Reagan ended up winning 44 states. And many of your colleagues in the Senate went down to defeat the same night, veteran Democrats, a slew of them. You were a survivor. Could this be another 1980?
I don't think so. I think we would, first of all, there were vast differences between the circumstances in 1980 and today. And what's interesting to me is most of the polls and analysis show that the majority of Americans know that Barack Obama is not responsible for the economic situation we're in. That shows an awful lot of intelligence and wisdom on the part of the voters, because it happens to be a fact. And the fact that voters understand that makes a huge bit of difference. I think it is very close. I think an awful lot of people are confused, and when they are confused, they say, let's try something else, and that's the biggest problem President Obama has. But his situation today and that of President Carter's are much, much different.
Now, in 1998, President Clinton named Senator Hart to a bipartisan commission charged with studying America's defense against terrorism. If I remember right, Senator, you issued a report in January of 2001, 8 months before the attack on America. What did your report indicate?
Well, actually, our mandate was to think about U.S. national security for the first 25 years of the 21st century and advise changes in our post-Cold War strategy to the next president, whomever that might be. And it was a bipartisan commission. the most comprehensive study of U.S. national security since 1947, after World War II. And in the course of our deliberations, we discovered the terrorist threat. And as early as 1999 and 2000, warned the country that terrorism was coming to the United States of America. And in our final report to the new president, George W. Bush, we said terrorists will attack the United States and Americans will die on American soil, possibly in large numbers. The administration tragically did nothing, and our recommendations to create a new Department of Homeland Security were not acted on, and a few of us, myself included, continued to try to warn the country in speeches and articles, and in my case, a visit to Condoleezza Rice in the White House to say that terrorism was coming. And then that visit was September the 6th, 2001, 5 days before the attack. But nothing was done to prepare us.
You're saying you visited with Secretary Rice five days?
She was then National Security Advisor. She had actually been a supporter of mine when I ran for president when she was finishing her PhD at the University of Denver. So I knew her very well. And I just felt that that in my bones that something awful was going to happen. So I went. She had invited me to come see her. I went to see her, and I said, please, please get going on protecting the homeland. And all she said was, I'll talk to the vice president. And 5 days later, we were attacked.
Mm. I mentioned 1984. Walter Mondale received 6,900,000 votes in the Democratic primary. Gary Hart received 6,500,000. A very narrow victory for Walter Mondale over Gary Hart. Now, when Mondale got the nomination, it was considered to be a competitive election. Ronald Reagan, like President Obama, had some numbers that were not that good, a 7.2% unemployment rate, yet he won 49 states. Had you been the nominee, would it have been different?
Well, we will never know, will we? No. I like to believe it would have. I would offer as evidence a statement Mrs. Reagan made later that I, among all the Democrats who were running that year, and there started out to be six, including Senator John Glenn, that I was the only one they were worried about. And I think it was because of the age, striking age difference, and that I had offered a new blueprint for Democrats in the Democratic Party that would have been much different from the traditional New Deal economic approach and foreign policy. And I never got the chance. The difference in the nomination race in San Francisco at the convention were the so-called superdelegates. And they all went for Vice President Mondale, even though on the eve of the convention, I was leading in the polls against President Reagan.
Now, that was 1984, and Fritz Mondale chose Geraldine Ferraro as his running mate. That turned out to be a not-so-good selection. In 1972, when you were running George McGovern's campaign, Senator McGovern chose Tom Eagleton. How did that happen?
Oh, I don't think we have enough time. There have been whole books, including in this year, on that subject. It was the fact that we had to compete for the nomination right up to the last minute, literally the night of the nomination, and we're focused all of our efforts on securing the nomination and then turn to the vice presidency. That was point number one. Point number two was that Senator McGovern had always had in mind that were he to be the nominee, he could convince Senator Ted Kennedy to join him on the ticket. And so he had personally held out hopes of doing that, and he spent a good deal of that critical day in conversations with Senator Kennedy, and it was in the afternoon of the vice presidential nomination that Senator Kennedy finally said he would not do it. So there was a lot of scrambling going on.
Now, for those,
and by the way, it must be said that the late Senator Eagleton had a sterling reputation in Washington.
Yeah, and he ended up getting reelected time and again,
yes.
Which George McGovern pointed out. He lost, and Eagleton kept winning Senate races. But for those who know much about you, and I suspect our audience does, you're a graduate of Divinity School, correct?
That's true, and law school. And I went back to school late in life and got my Ph.D.
Yeah, and joined the reserve too, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I didn't. I never put it on my resume because I didn't want. I wasn't trying to politicize the military, but I was on the Armed Services Committee. I'd spent a lot of time with the troops, soldiers in the field, and sailors on board ship, and I thought a reserve. I was a Lieutenant JG, so it wasn't anything very grand.
And you've also written books under the name John Blackthorne, best-selling books.
Well, I've written a lot of books, actually, and five novels, including one that's out now called Durango. But the two Blackthorne books were spy thrillers having to do with Cuba and experiences that I had had down there. And I gather they're still being read here and there.
Mm-hmm. What is the focus of Durango?
It really is based on a true life story that I was involved in, a controversial water project in the southwest corner of our state. And on top of that, I overlay a Greek play by Sophocles having to do with exile and return, the classic Odyssey theme. And real people I knew and some of whom are still alive are in the book, but it is a fictional treatment of what happened during that controversial period and does involve the Southern Ute Indian tribe.
Well, Senator Gary Hart, a pleasure to speak with you today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Take care and best of luck. Do it again soon, I hope. And for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. We'll, of course, follow the debate tonight on WRKF, and we'll be back tomorrow to talk about this and more. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.